Welcome to Dad's on the Air for May the 6th, 2008. Should be a really interesting show. We've got the new Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Elizabeth Broderick, on the show. That should be a really interesting, very interesting program coming up. And I'd like to welcome everybody who's joining us from around the world via live streaming on the 2GLF website. And don't forget, you can listen to this program later today, again, at www.dadsontheair.net. It's a sparkling new website and it's looking terrific, dadsontheair.net. Really interesting story first up on the Sydney Morning Herald front page today about a bloke who, there's a story going around in Australia that one of the doctors is encouraging people to sell their kidneys for, say, $50,000. And it reads, Craig Gill took less than 30 seconds to decide that he would sell his kidney to finance ballet lessons and a home deposit for his two-year-old daughter, Patel. After reading yesterday's Herald and the call by a Canberra specialist to legalise the sale of kidneys in Australia, Mr. Gill, 44, called the paper seeking to place an advertisement for one of the kidneys for $50,000. Who else would show this level of self-sacrifice? Just straight up, an amazing level of self-sacrifice that fathers show. He said, my daughter is my future and I am willing to put my hand up and sell an organ to someone to help her, he said. A cheque for $50,000 would help her to avoid Sydney's rental crisis when she's older. I don't want my girl out there street fighting with hundreds of others for somewhere to live. If a relative needed a kidney from me, I'd give it to them without a second thought. But when it comes to strangers, I want to be well compensated for it because my priority is my daughter and her future. And I would say most of my friends feel the way I do. We'd do anything to help our kids get a start in life. I think that's just an amazing example of the level of self-sacrifice that most fathers show.
Well, I think it's actually quite typical. I mean, this is a very over-the-top example, but so many dads are out there. Every single dangerous and deadly job in Australia, whether it's working in a coal mine, working in the military, you name it, all of the longest, hardest, deadliest jobs are done by dads, and they're doing them to support their families. And these are things that dads do every day. It's just an everyday thing for dads. And one more example.
Really?
Yeah, I'd sell my kidney at $50,000, absolutely.
Nobody wants your kidney, mate, for God's sake.
Keep your bloody kidney over there, pal.
How many kidneys have we got, by the way?
Two.
Two, so we got
a
spare.
And you've given them both a fair bashing.
Well, no, isn't that my liver?
Well, I think it's both, isn't it? I'm not a doctor. All right, another story that's been kicking around this week, and this is a press release from the Law Council. Of Australia. The Law Council has supported the End Same-Sex Discrimination and has welcomed the announcement that the Commonwealth laws which discriminate against same-sex as gay couples will be either gone or on the way out by year's end. The government announced that it will introduce legislation in the winter sittings of Parliament to eliminate discrimination against same-sex couples in over 100 areas of Commonwealth law. This includes 58 areas identified by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission in a report released last year.
Long overdue, about time.
Well, yes, I don't think there'd be much argument from anyone here, but why don't they do the same thing for the discrimination which is rampant against dads?
And against men in general. I mean, the state governments are tumbling over each other to be the first to introduce new rape laws, which basically paint all men as who have sex with women as potential rapists, and that a woman who's drunk when she has sex can then come back the next day and throw the guy in jail saying that she was raped. I mean, this sort of discrimination affects 50% of the population, and they're doing nothing about it. But that's to take nothing away from, you know, this is an absolutely fantastic initiative. But, you know, we've got to get our priorities right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is based on the stuff that was South Australian Parliament was trying to bring in with their new rape laws, where the woman could change her mind weeks after the event and decide that she didn't really want that after all, and that was constituted as rape.
I know. We're going to talk a little bit more about that whole issue later in the show. There's been some very interesting articles around that. The Law Council President, Ross Ray QC, said any step towards eliminating discrimination brings us closer to meeting our international human rights obligations, makes us a fairer, more just community, and ought to be greeted with strong approval. Now, absolutely no one in Australia, bar the recipients or the beneficiaries of the status quo, pretend that family law is not biased against men, and that much of the bureaucracy, the child support and legal aid bureaucracies, are not biased against fathers. But why don't they remove that discrimination as well? It'd be very nice if they showed the same willingness to address these issues as they are against gay couples, who are a significantly, I think, lesser number than dads.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from personal experience, having to deal with the Federal Magistrates Court and to deal with Centrelink and various other government bodies, is the most gender-biased thing, gender-biased against males, the whole system. I've been absolutely shocked with my own personal experiences in trying to deal with these organisations. As to the fact that I'm a man and therefore there's something wrong with my having full-time custody of my children. There's something wrong. What's wrong with this picture? How can this guy have full-time custody of his children? Where's the mother?
I think a lot of dads have come straight up against this. And, of course, one woman's pain is every woman's pain, but one man's pain is a public embarrassment. And we see that every day.
Well, I've spent my entire adult life, my young life, formative years, being bombarded with this business about, that the women are the underclass or the undergender, if you like, and that, men have it good in society and men have it, every way we want it. And then, of course, when you come into these experiences, you find out that that's actually not the case at all. And it was a real eye-opener for me, especially, getting on in my age in life.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of these issues will come up in the interviews we've got later in the show of Elizabeth Broderick, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. Of course, Australia is regarded as one of the best countries in the world to be a woman. The United Nations ranks it as one of the very best countries in the world to live if you're a woman. It certainly doesn't rank that way as a man. As always, there's child support stories kicking around. Here we go.
Indeed there is, John. Thanks, mate. I'm reading from the Courier Mail from yesterday, and its headline says, Queensland fathers shirk child support payments. Fathers in Queensland are the nation's worst offenders when it comes to shirking child support payments. New data shows many parents, most of them fathers, living in southeast Queensland, have turned their backs on their children. The Child Support Agency's statistics show parents at Broadbeach, Mermaid Beach and Palm Beach on the Gold Coast and Deception Bay north of Brisbane are the least likely to meet their child support payments.
I would have thought this was more an example of men dropping out of the system as a result of the Child Support Agency, and a very significant number of them do drop out of work and basically drop out of the system or go back to university.
They do, and, child support are spending millions upon millions of dollars to try and catch these guys.
This all comes, of course, ahead of reforms to the Child Support Agency, reform in very big quotation marks there, that are due in July, and the government was party to those changes. We've asked the architect of those changes, Patrick Parkinson, onto the program. He has found himself far too busy to be able to come onto Dad's on the Air, although he also found himself plenty of time to be able to fly over to London recently and argue that they should keep their haphazard and hilariously disastrous child support system over in London. Just unbelievable. And very disappointing that he could not find his way onto Dad's on the Air to explain.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise, yes. And?
Well, look, back to what we were saying before about the gender biasness in this society. I mean, a little tidbit here is that Australia's traditional middle class is being swallowed up by the higher cost of living. Our so-called working families are the working poor, and it is single women who are doing it the toughest financially. A community paper produced for the federal government's 2020 summit says there will be about 450,000 older single women households by 2026, compared with about 200,000 lone male households.
The reason there's 200,000 and so many more women is because all the blokes die much earlier than the women. And the crudest example of the disparity between the sexes, we've got...
Exactly. Huh. I have to agree with it in general. I mean, I could say my mother is a single woman living on a pension, and at $259 a week, it's quite pathetic. She has to cover her basics such as rent, food, and utilities, and so on. It's really, I think, a failing. When we're talking about financial matters for lone people, and then when Dad's on the Air is about obviously to do with families and separation and childs and so on, children and so on. But just briefly on the subject. I would say that there, in this respect, there is no gender biasness. So whether you're a single old male pensioner or a single old female pensioner, the living conditions or toughness, if you've got no superannuation and no assets, is equally the same. But it's an excellent point that you just raised, John, because this is a community paper produced for the federal government's 2020 summit. Obviously that paper, not obviously, but I would assume that paper wouldn't point out what you've just pointed out, and that was the longer life expectancy of women over men. It follows, okay, I'll just finish off the last paragraph. This follows a report to the Senate last month, which identified single pensioners, in particular older women, as at extreme risk of falling into poverty. Older women had little or no superannuation, and their meagre singles pensions had to stretch further than couples to cover basics such as rent, food, petrol and utilities. Well, I don't know about petrol. I mean, if you can afford to have a car, then, Anyway, but that's the thrust of that article.
And I just forgot to introduce everybody. So in the studio today, we have with us Philip York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
Our researcher and webmaster, Greg Anderson.
Good day, everyone.
Jeremy Horton, aka Jermaine Diarrhea.
Jermaine Diarrhea here. Good morning to you all.
We're thrilled to have her back. Yeah. And Ian Purdy, the legendary.
Well, yes. Good morning, John.
Good morning. And you're going to close the news section of the show with...
Oh, I will, yes. There's an article in today's Telegraph. It's a great article. This one has the makings of a soap opera script right with inside it. Under the heading, TV deal paid for divorce. Byron Kay writes, Chappelle Corby's estranged friend yesterday revealed why she took cash to discredit the convicted drug smuggler's sister on national television, and the reason was to pay for her divorce. Jodie Power, former best friend of Corby's sister, Mercedes, even admitted under oath to trying to hide her $100,000 payment for the interview so her ex-husband would not get any of it. Her ex-husband was not the only one Power hid her payment from. She admitted she still had not declared it to the Australian Tax Office. She denied abusing drugs but admitted to smoking joints daily, including while pregnant and in front of her children. I've educated my children to say no to drugs, she said, through the tears.
She was puffing away on a joint.
So there you go. That's got everything. It's sex, drugs, rock and roll, you name it. That should be the basis of the Chappelle Corby soap opera series.
It does illustrate the point we've repeatedly tried to make, that the whole system as it is hurts both men and women, and that we really need equality in this whole arena, which we're not getting. And it's just a good example of the lengths people will go to get enough money to, as anyone would, fight for their kids. We'll be back.
To feather the pockets of certain professions.
Well, the legal profession is very well
fed. Don't get me started
on
that one.
We'll be back. We'll be talking with Elizabeth Broderick, the new Sex Discrimination Commissioner.
This is the way you left me. I'm not pretending. No hope, no love, no glory, no happy ending. This is the way that we love, like it's forever. Then live the rest of our life, but not together.
In the morning, stumble on my life. Can't get no love without sacrifice. If anything should happen, I guess I wish you well. A little bit of heaven, but a little bit of hell.
This is the hardest story that I've ever told. No hope, love, or glory, happy endings gone forevermore.
On my mind, can't get no rest, keep walking around. If I pretend that nothing ever went wrong, can get to my sleep, I can think that we just carried on. This is the hardest story that I've ever told. No hope of love or glory, happy endings gone forevermore. Oh, feel as if I'm wasted. And I'm wasted every day.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line now we have with us Elizabeth Broderick, and she is the new Sex Discrimination Commissioner and the Commissioner responsible for age discrimination. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on Dad's on the Air this morning.
Thanks very much, Greg, and it's good to speak to you again.
Now, you've been very busy over the last few months since you were appointed as Sex Discrimination Commissioner with a listening tour. I believe you've been travelling all over Australia talking and listening to people about their views on a number of issues. Would you like to tell our listeners a bit about that tour?
Yes, you're right, Greg. I have been travelling extensively. I've been from the abattoirs of South Australia to the long grass camps of the Northern Territory of Darwin. And my idea behind it was, look, I figured I could come into this role and just sit in another high-rise building in Sydney and say, look, these are the issues that I think matter around the sex and age discrimination agendas. Or I could actually get out and talk to men and women in Australia today and find out, look, what are the issues that are important to them? What are the issues that they're dealing with in their lives? And that's exactly what I decided to do. So it has been an incredible experience. We've spoken to a huge array of people from men's only focus groups, women's only focus groups. We've been out to workplaces, business roundtables, academic roundtables, public consultations, NGOs. So it's been a very extensive trip.
And what are some of the stories that you've heard on the listening tour? I guess most of our listeners are men and fathers. And what are some of the issues that men have raised on the tour?
Look, it's interesting to me because I don't see gender equality as a battle of the sexes at all. It's about men and women coming together to create a fairer and more equal Australia. So I've been really keen to hear the voices of men. I suppose one of the main themes coming through, and these are from some of the focus groups that I ran with men in workplaces. Some of them were blue-collar workplaces, some of them were white-collar occupations, and in metropolitan and regional areas. But they really talked a lot about trying to reconcile their family responsibilities with their working hours, And whether they were casual or salaried long hours workers, there's a lot of pressure that men feel, particularly where they are sole breadwinners, and particularly when their children are born, and the family pressure that comes on to men at that particular time. So that was one of the themes that came through. Another theme was the ability of men to access family-friendly policies such as paid leave or flexible work arrangements. Yes, women also spoke to me about how difficult that was, but I think for some men it was even more difficult than it was for women. And then I suppose another thing, one of the things when we met with the Men's Line Service and men's advocates, they also talked about the health needs of men and that there was support for a national men's policy, including increased funding for, you know, specific men's health initiatives. So they're some of the major themes that came out for me on the tour.
Now, obviously, you're just sort of winding up listening to her at the moment. I guess you're going to spend some time digesting all of the themes.
Mm.
Of those themes that you heard from Australian Men and Fathers, are there any of those that you think you might like to pick up in terms of future action in your five-year term as the Commissioner?
Yeah, look, definitely, particularly around those work and family issues for men. And there's a good convergence there with, I suppose, those issues for women, although I do agree that in some circumstances they are actually harder for men. So definitely around those issues. And also monitoring the work of a new office for work and family in Canberra. I mean, to the extent of a men's health policy, I know ALP policy is that they will work towards implementing a men's health strategy. Now, I'm not exactly sure where that's at, but, you know, that seems to make sense, particularly to the extent of men coming together to talk about what it is that they want and what they need. And I think also when I look at the age discrimination issues, Greg, most of the complaints that we have in that area are coming from men, particularly older men, I suppose, who want to have some transitioned retirement. So they don't want retirement to be a point where they never earn another cent again. And their ability to continue on in workplaces to ensure that they can access some level of flexibility as well. So those are issues that definitely will be things that we'll be working towards over the next few years.
Now, one of the hot topics of discussion in the media over recent years, as well as on your listening tour, has been the issue of paid parental leave in Australia and a national scheme.
Mm.
Now, Sweden has implemented a very progressive leave scheme that allows both mums and dads to take paid leave to care for their young children. Are you a supporter of a national paid parental leave scheme, and if such a scheme were introduced, how would you see that the leave provisions would differ for mums and dads?
Yeah, I am a supporter of a nationally legislated scheme because I talk to men and women on the listening tour. Yes, only one in three mums is currently using a form of paid maternity leave, and it's even worse when you look at for men. I think the figures are one in four, one in five for men. And when you look at it, the ones that currently don't have access are often the ones that need access. They're people who don't work in large organisations. They're people who are probably lesser paid and also people who are not working for government. So I am absolute supporter behind a national legislated scheme. And in fact, we're currently developing our submission to the Productivity Commission inquiry into paid maternity, paternity and parental leave. And I do think there's a lot of financial stress on families when a baby comes along. We've got some research there which shows that employed partnered fathers actually are working harder and longer when the baby comes along. And, you know, maybe that's because of this additional burden around being a sole breadwinner. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I know there is financial stress on families. I think the thinking has come along in the past. Heriok recommended a national scheme of 14 weeks paid maternity leave for women, paid at the level of a federal minimum wage. And I think we will be formulating exactly what our proposal will be, but I think the thinking as a community as well has moved along about the importance of men bonding from day one with their children. And if we're serious about that, then I think there is a case for a broader scheme, including specific elements for fathers. Now, what that might look like and how the weeks and whatever are divided up, I'm not exactly sure. And we shouldn't forget that it is women who actually do the childbearing and have the physical ramifications of that and importance of establishing breastfeeding. But I do think, as a community, our thinking's moved on about the importance of having fathers involved in their children's lives from a very early age.
One of the elements in the Swedish model is in 1995 they introduced a father's month requirement, which required the father to take at least 30 days of parental leave or the parents would lose their entitlement for that month. Do you think that perhaps because of the entrenched workplace cultures that aren't very supportive of men taking time off to care for their families, and often the men themselves believe that they won't be supported if they... even if they desperately want to take time off. Do you think something like that built into the legislation, which sort of gives employers and the dads that extra sort of shove to take time off, do you think that would be something that's worth considering?
Yeah. I think there will be an educative value which will come with any national scheme as well, so I agree with that. I agree it's really important to encourage fathers to be involved in the care of their children, and paid leave's definitely an element of that. Those Scandinavian countries have got, you know, really excellent schemes, but they have been evolutionary as well. So how we actually start out, I don't envisage is how we'll, over the next few years, end up, if I can put it like that. This will be evolving. But I'd say watch this space, because I'm hoping that some good things will happen here.
We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with more of Liz Broderick after this track.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And we'll be back with our pre-recorded interview with the new Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Elizabeth Broderick, in a moment. Really striking to hear the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner say, "I am keen to hear the voices of men." It's traditionally not been that sympathetic to any of men's concerns, the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner. Of course, the current Governor-General, Quentin Bryce, was a former Sex Discrimination Commissioner. It's very unlikely you would have heard those words, "I'm keen to hear the voices of men," out of her predecessor, Prue Goward, who was pretty much reviled by her father's groups around the country.
Well, I remember Prue Goward, when she was the Commissioner, she came down to the National Men's Health Conference in Melbourne, and, you know, this is a group, and there's 300 men's health practitioners in the room, and they're all, you know, obviously a very, you know, it's not an audience that you, want to attack men on, but she came out and she, it was the most outrageous speech I'd ever heard. She was talking about if men did more housework, they'd be healthier, and how, you know, the only reason men are unhealthy is because of this poisonous masculinity that's running through their veins and stuff. It was really shocking. So Elizabeth, I think, is a real breath of fresh air, and very genuinely got open ears to the concerns of men, I think.
It's certainly remarkable that she seems prepared to engage. Yes, another Prue Goward anecdote. During the family law reform debate, she dismissed fathers as saying that, oh, they'd all need an auto cue to remember the names of their children. It was really, she played a really spoiling role in the whole family law reform push. It's one of the reasons why it failed, was straight down to the former Sex Discrimination Commissioner. So it's really good news, isn't it, to see a Sex Discrimination Commissioner at least listening.
She's talking the talk. If she can walk the walk, maybe it's not all doom and gloom, and with the new Rudd Labor government, it's not all going to be a feminist-inspired kind of mandate that we're all going to have to live with here.
Absolutely. I mean, she seemed very supportive of the ALP's proposed National Men's Health Policy, which is great, and a supporter of, obviously, she's keen to get maternity leave on the agenda, but obviously she seems to be supportive of some sort of paternity leave as well, which will really help new dads. I know a couple of mates of mine have had kids recently, and that's just been absolutely distressing for them to have to, they take a week off work, maybe not even paid, and then they have to go straight back to work, with this 1 week-old child that they desperately want to take more time off to look after. I mean, it'd be fantastic to have at least a month or so of paid leave for dads as well. And she seems to be hinting that she'd be supportive of something like that. So.
Well, at least she's prepared to talk about it as a serious issue.
Yeah.
Is that something that would replace the baby bonus? Is that the whole idea, that we scrap the incredibly expensive baby bonus, now about $5,000 a baby, and introduce this paid leave scheme instead? Is that the idea?
I'm not sure. I think what's happened is the new government has referred the whole issue of parental leave to the Productivity Commission, and they're basically doing this study, and people can write submissions, and I think they will then come up with recommendations to government for what would happen, whether they would have the baby bonus as well or whether the leave would replace that. I mean, in my view, I think paid leave makes a lot more sense than giving just the cash bonus to mums on the birth of their children. It certainly will stop some parents who go out and buy flat screen TVs with the money that's supposed to be spent on nappies or whatever.
So. Of course, some of the poorer towns in New South Wales, every girl under 18 is pregnant, you know, partly as a result of that cash bonus that they see at the end of it. It's had some really appalling effects, certainly amongst lower socioeconomic groups.
So paid maternity leave is not going to be any use to people like that because they don't work. Obviously, they're getting the baby bonus and they're living on it. They don't have a job, so offering them paid maternity leave from work, from the imaginary fictitious job that they don't have, is not going to be any solution to anything.
Yes, but if it's that scheme would be set at the minimum wage, wouldn't it? So that would, they'd get that for 14 weeks, even if they're on the dole, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I guess time will tell. And as you say, she's talking the talk, which is great. And we'll it's very early days. She's got a 5-year stint, and we'll see what happens when you know, over that term, and what happens in terms of actions. But it's looking good, certainly.
It's certainly refreshing that there isn't the same level of hostility that we've seen in the past towards FAO, and the same contempt that's been directed at men. We'll be back in a short moment, and we'll have more of the Elizabeth Broderick interview.
just the way I am. Shorty should understand that I stay on the ground all the time, and that is what makes me a man. Better that than on the streets. See, I do that for my queen, and I give her what she needs as long as she looks after me. And I represent Wood and Block. South Oakland is on top. I do it my way, I don't stop. Young demons make it pop. I do it all here for you. Hold it down for the truth. Who's stepping up on the floor? Watch everyone do it too. Come on.
Dad's on the air. On the line we have with us Liz Broderick, the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner. Now, there seems to be a perception amongst many Australian men, and certainly some of the listeners to our program, that the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission's Sex Discrimination Unit has been in the past a bit of a women's discrimination unit, as it seems to have focused mainly on discrimination against women and girls, and it doesn't seem to have done a lot to address many of men's concerns, such as the underfunding of men's health, the high rates of male suicide, and the lack of services for male victims of domestic violence. Do you think it's fair to say that the Sex Discrimination Unit has been a bit biased towards women's concerns? And do you see the role of the unit being to reduce discrimination on the basis of sex against all Australians, whether they're female or male?
Look, the object under that Sex Discrimination Act is to ensure the equality of men and women in Australian society. And my unit here is actually made up of two elements. One is the sex part of it, the other is the age discrimination unit. So I have both those areas of responsibility. And it is a small policy unit. Many people think it's very large. It's not. It's small. You've been in here, Greg, you know.
Absolutely.
So it does limit our capacity to do as much work as we would like to, you know, generally. But the other thing I should point out is, unfortunately, I can't, I suppose some would say fortunately, I can't just follow everything that I want to. I need to come from the legislative base that I have. And that base is set out very firmly in the sex and age discrimination legislation. And in fact, if you look at the Sex Discrimination Act, it does partially implement the federal government's international obligations as a signatory to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So that's part of a basis behind it. But having said that, look, I do think I have a role in monitoring areas where men may be disadvantaged. And as you and I have chatted about before, Greg, I absolutely don't think gender equality should be about a battle of the sexes. It's not a zero-sum game where men win and women lose, or women win and men lose. It's about, I think, looking at the status of men and women relative to each other, and then working out, okay, are there areas where, given our limited amount of resources and staff capacity and whatever, where we can have some good impact? And I do really believe that if I can make the areas, particularly around work and family balance over the life cycle, work well for men and for women, then I've actually done something that matters, that to allow men to access family-friendly policies to the same extent as women. Because I think, you know, particularly for not just young men, but men in Australia today, they're seeing their role, particularly inside the family, differently than they previously may have.
Now, many listeners to Dads on the Air are separated dads, and
right.
A lot of them are they're loving hands-on fathers who they entered the family court system during their divorces, believing that they'd be fairly treated, and once they entered that system, they found themselves, a lot of them, shut out of their children's lives entirely. A lot of them haven't seen their children for many years.
Mm.
Or they may have been reduced to once a fortnight visitors. And these are dads who, previous to the divorce, you know, were looking after their kids every day in a very hands-on capacity.
Mm.
What do you think could be done to ensure that children can continue to have their fathers actively involved in their lives if a relationship does break up and there is a divorce?
Because it's a really complex area of law, this area. But I suppose from where I come from, which is very much a human rights-based perspective, working in here at the Human Rights Commission, the issue must be about the best interests of a child. And that means that it needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. But having said that, we know from research that the earlier that they are involved in their children's lives, the better equipped they are to continue that involvement throughout the child's lives. And I think that applies to both coupled and also separated families. And this is another reason, Greg, why I think it's really important that, you know, if we have a nationally legislated scheme of paid maternity leave, that actually men do have an opportunity to be involved right from the beginning with their children, but also that they are able to access family-friendly work arrangements so that they can be actively involved in their children's lives and just in family relationships more broadly.
Now, obviously, if that were to take place and the dads are spending a lot more time with their kids, I'm just hypothesising here, if they are then find themselves, you know, separated from their children as a result of the family law scheme, it's almost going to hurt them even more. I can imagine we're almost going to have increased rates of suicide if they've been even more involved with their kids and then the kids are taken out of their lives.
Mm.
Have you had a chance to study the previous government's amendments to the Family Law Act, and do you think that they are heading in the right direction in terms of possibly moving towards more of a shared care model after separation and divorce, obviously not in the cases where there's any violence or abuse, but just in the general cases?
Mm.
Well, do you think that's heading in the right direction?
Yeah, I haven't, I suppose, had an in-depth look at it, mainly because it hasn't been a strong theme compared to all the other themes that have come through on the listening tour.
Of course.
But I suppose, where I come from is that it does need to be about the best interests of a child, but that we are seeing and hope to support men's involvement in the lives of their children from the very early stages, and that we should continue to allow men to be involved in their children's lives.
We'll be back shortly.
I'm dying, I'm missing my girl. My heart, it's so broken, my head's in a whirl. I'm crying, I'm dying, missing my little girl. Oh, it seems to me like the end of the world. Now I thought kidnapping, that it was a crime. And I thought if you'd done it, that you would do time. Yeah, my wife, she left me, she took my child away. But apparently fathers, they have no say. Oh, I'm crying, I'm dying, I'm missing my girl. My heart, it's so broken, my head's in a whirl. I know that she loves me, she'll be missing me so. How a mother could do it, I'll never know. Black man, but they made me sign papers or see her no more. The laws, they are crazy, they're just so unfair. My daughter's half mine, but my wife won't share. She's lying, she's trying to take my little girl. The most precious thing to me in the world. She knows what she's doing is cruel and not right. She's using my little girl simply for spite. But they won't help my daughter or listen to me. Yeah, they call this justice, but I fail to see. I wish there was someone to help my girl and me. Oh, I'm crying, I'm dying, missing my girl. My heart, it's so broken, my head's in a whirl. I'm crying, I'm dying, missing my little girl. The most precious thing to me in the world. She's the most precious thing to me in this world.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Well, I thought it was a little bit disappointing to hear Broderick using that much-worn phrase, the best interests of children, which, of course, is one of the most dishonestly used phrases in Australia today. We have these grotesquely overpaid lawyers running around the family law system claiming spuriously to be acting in the best interests of children when they're doing absolutely nothing of the kind. I suppose
how on earth is removing a father from a child's life in the best interest of a child? I mean, really?
In the best interest of the lawyer's children, because they get well paid for it, you see.
At least the previous government was honest enough to remove that obligation from the child support legislation. The child support agency is no longer under any obligation to act in the best interest of children, and the previous government, by a bit of subterfuge, removed that obligation, and because they knew, of course, that it wasn't acting in the best interests of children. But it's very disappointing to see that phrase being bandied around.
I think we have to clarify here, all of us believe that the Family Law Act should genuinely be in the best interest of children. The problem is that phrase, the best interests of children, is used to mean the best interests of lawyers, the best interests of mothers, everything but the actual best interests of children.
It's usually jargon to mean sole mother custody.
Yeah, it's usually what it means. In the worst interest of fathers.
So that's a little bit disappointing, but it's very interesting to see her engaging with it. That would be very interesting too. There's a story in today's Telegraph. Workers would pay a levy averaging $5.70 a week to fund a paid maternity leave scheme delivering mothers 6 month leave under the first serious maternity leave proposal put before the federal government. A former senior public servant has drawn up plans for the $3.5 billion scheme that will be examined by the Productivity Commission inquiry into paid maternity leave, and that begins tomorrow.
The taxpayer is ultimately going to stump up for the bill for this, but they're making it obvious. Now, a little known fact there is that Australia is one of the only developed countries or Western countries in the world that actually doesn't already have a paid maternity scheme. Okay, so we are behind the Western world in this. Paid maternity leave, yeah, it's going to be, the taxpayer's going to stump up for it. And how much we have to pay for it is going to be the question.
And most countries do include dads in that equation, don't they?
Absolutely. You see, this is the thing. Are we including fathers in this equation? Is this act or is this new paid maternity leave situation going to include men?
Mm. Well, time will tell. Like you say, the commission, this hearing starts tomorrow. So
yeah, starts tomorrow. At least Broderick is showing some sympathy towards that position, which no one else seems to. So that's good,
isn't
it?
Well, she was very diplomatic when she was speaking to Al Gregg. Yeah. I don't know, you know what I mean?
See, I mean, as businesses, from a business perspective, I mean, you've got someone employed, and, it's a female, and she's a valuable employee, which has knowledge that's very hard and expensive to replace if you're going to retrain somebody, then a paid maternity scheme, if you can't afford, if you're a small business, to pay that person to take time off while they have a child, then, you're going to lose money. And small businesses can't afford to lose money because the other side of that is that there's a potential for that business to suffer, which means other people could go out of work, which again has an impact in other ways on the tax system of this country through Social Security and so on. And these other people have families to look after as well. So it's a very broad the subject of paid maternity leave leads into a lot of other areas. And we can assume that when paid maternity leave, we're not talking about single mums here. We're talking about a young couple having their first child.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think it needs to be. We need to establish that it's a very important subject.
It's amazing that dads are just entirely left out of the debate, though. There's no sex discrimination commissioner presenting men's issues in this maternity or paternity leave debate at
all.
The groups are all missing in action, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the sex discrimination commission, they say they will be putting or have put in a submission to that, and I'd be interested to see whether that includes provisions for new dads. Hopefully it will, but as Ian said before, time will tell. Well, I guess we'll see what they recommended.
Well, I was in a stable relationship when I had both my boys, and, I'd have liked to have been given a couple of months off with my newborns, and paid. Mm. But I did take time off, but I took it from my annual leave.
Which most dads do, and, absolutely.
I sacrificed that in order to spend time with my newborn. So it'd be interesting to see the outcome of this, but I think we can all predict what it's going to be.
Now, the other issue that was raised in that second part of the interview was whether the sex discrimination legislation actually, in a sense, ties the hands of the commissioner, because the sex discrimination legislation partly is to do with making Australia comply with its international obligations under the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, not discrimination on the basis of sex or gender, but only against women. There is a sense in which Elizabeth's commission has to deal more with women's issues than men's issues, and that legislation, it's almost Orwellian that the sex discrimination legislation is sexist because it talks only about women to some degree. And that is what needs fixing.
Yeah.
And the degree of irony that the fact that it's been headed up by a woman?
Well, it always has been. I think there was a bloke very briefly at one time.
Well, John Van Dusen, who's the head of the whole Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission, he stood in because they were in between commissioners. But generally, it's always been a woman, and all of the staff, all of the current staff, are women. And I think that does say a little bit about the sort of issues that they're going to end up covering.
But certainly a lot of men do make complaints to the Sex Discrimination Commissioner.
Well, here we are, early 21st century, and if you were to say to any person on the street, male or female, it doesn't matter, and whether Gen X, Gen Y, whatever, say, what's the first thing you think of when if I say to you sexual discrimination? They're going to say, well, obviously some sort of discrimination against women. The thought that men can be discriminated against based upon gender is just something that society in general doesn't have in its head and it doesn't accept. It doesn't see that there is a possibility to discriminate against men based on the fact that they are men.
And that's because after 30 or 40 years of feminism, our broader culture has bought the feminist myth, the feminist lie that we are living in a patriarchy. And because we all have bought this lie that men have all the power and men run the world, the thought of them being discriminated against is like, what?
And, of course, feminism has always been draped in a lot of social justice rhetoric, and we all support equality, and that's the way it's portrayed a lot of these anti-family and anti-father ideologies, which are now, a lot of these people went to university that are now in power now in senior levels of the bureaucracy, went to university in the early 70s and are basically parroting what their very left-wing professors of the era said.
Women's Studies 101.
We'll be back.
I fought her, and I fought her. We were like two lambs at the slaughter. Neither the earth nor the wind nor the flame could tame her. Under the water was the place with Neptune's daughter. Under the water I sought her. The light from the surface, the sea ablaze with rays, deeper and deeper, but I could not see her. Then all at once she appeared. Now I'm under the water with Neptune's daughter. I'm under the water, Neptune's daughter. Lost in the currents that moved around, 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 around me. Somehow she found me. I'm under the water, Neptune's daughter. We don't need air, we got everything here. The fish and the sea, they're enough for me. I'm under the water with Neptune's daughter.
Dad's on the air. On the phone, we have with us the new Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Elizabeth Broderick. Now, one of the other themes of your listening tour is around discrimination, harassment and violence. You recently wrote on your blog that you look forward to working with the new federal government to ensure that women in Australia can exercise their right to live a life free from violence. And I'm sure all the listeners to Dad's on the Air, as well as us in here in the studio, would very much support that. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, the Australian Bureau of Statistics had a survey in 2005 called the Personal Safety Survey, and it showed that young men in Australia, these are sort of 18 to 25-year-old men, three times as likely as young women to be victims of violence. Now, these are all sorts of violence. This is violence at the pub and, you know, at work, and as well as violence in the home and sexual assault, all those sort of things. Now, I'm sure you're aware that the previous government ran a very large advertising campaign called Violence Against Women, Australia Says No, and that obviously dealt with violence against women.
How do you think such a campaign might be able to be modified as a public health measure to try and help reduce the appalling levels of violence against men in Australia?
Because you're right, there are clearly high levels of violence in our community. Look, it's a whole of society problem, and yeah, as you say, it's got many causes. I mean, no violence is acceptable.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. No violence is acceptable. That includes violence against men and, of course, violence against women. And as you say, men are much more likely to be the victims of violence by people that they don't know, whereas probably women are more likely to experience kind of intimate partner violence. But I don't think that just because maybe the stats look like that, and as you say, the stats of violence generally against men are increasingly high. And I think in New South Wales, assaults are on the increase, you know, rather than going the other way. So I think that men's needs as victims of violence are important. The responses to it are really state-based, given that, you know, I'm at the federal level. They're not something that I have a mandate to particularly be involved in. But I think all victims have a right to support services, all victims of violence. And, you know, that's something that needs to be continued to be encouraged.
Now, one last question before we wind it up. As I'm sure you're aware, almost 50% more women than men graduated from Australia's universities last year. Now, that's been a real turnaround over the last 20 years or so. 20 years ago, there were probably that many more men than women graduating, and it's done a real backflip over that time. Now, obviously, all of us would love to see a real equality in education, that, you know, similar numbers of women and men were getting good educations and going on to higher degrees and obviously entering, you know, the higher levels of business and government. However, there does seem to be a real crisis for our young boys and men in the education system. Do you have any ideas on how we might be able to improve the learning environments for boys, right through from kindergarten to university, to try and address this crisis?
It's interesting. I didn't realise that stat about 50% higher, but I do know generally that women are graduating in greater numbers across most of the courses than men. And if I look at my own background as a lawyer, Greg, I think 68.8% of graduates from Australian universities in law are female. So there is some disparity there. Look, as a mother of a son and a daughter, I know that boys and girls actually, it's my limited experience here, but learn in different ways. And I'd like to see that both learning styles are recognised and to see them both grow up with, as you say, exactly the same learning opportunities. At least, even if you can't look at outcomes, but we need the same learning opportunities.
Right.
And I think when I look for boys, it is still the case that there are few men in teaching, particularly in the public school system. But I think that kind of, it's indicative of a broader issue about how we ensure that teaching's once again valued and that, you know, salaries that teachers receive can support families if to the extent we look at sole breadwinner models, which is very difficult in, say, living in most capital cities now, just to have one person working in any event. But to the extent that we can attract both men and women back into the teaching profession, that we can value that profession, respect a reasonable level of remuneration, I think that's two of the most important things that we can be doing. And at the end of the day, teaching is one of the most important roles in our community. I mean, as parents, we all know that.
I know that under your predecessor, there was a move, I think, by some of the Catholic education system to introduce scholarships for males entering the teaching profession in order to encourage more male teachers. Is that the sort of idea that you think may have some sort of merit, especially if we continue to give scholarships to women who want to enter engineering and IT and those sort of professions that are male-dominated?
Look, there needs to be equal educational opportunities. I agree with you there, but I do think the broader issue around teaching, once again, is how do we value teaching? That's what's changed, I think, from when I was at school to the teaching environment now. It's that broader issue, is how do we ensure that teachers get the respect that they deserve, that the teaching profession is once again valued, and that it is at the level where it absolutely should be if we're serious about having a, you know, educated Australia.
Absolutely. That sounds like a fantastic note on which to end our interview today. thank you so much for coming on Dad's on the Air today. Liz, would you like to give the contact details for your website once again,
sure,
in case any of our listeners want to jump on and have a look at the blog and about some of the other issues that you've been talking about on your listening tour?
Yeah, thanks very much, Greg, and thanks for inviting me on. I'm keen to hear all voices, and it's great that we've been able to make contact early on in my term and that you've actively sought me out early on, because that has allowed me also to focus on a whole range of issues. So thanks for doing that. In relation to the website, if people are interested, it's www.humanrights.gov.au, or this will get you to the same place, which is www.hreoc.gov.au.
Liz Broderick, the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner and Commissioner responsible for age discrimination, thank you so much for coming on Dad's on the Air this morning, and we wish you all the best for the next 5 years.
Thanks very much, Greg.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Yes, and we'd really like to send a heartfelt thanks to Elizabeth Broderick for coming on to Dad's on the Air. It was a really interesting interview, and it's terrific to see that she's engaging with fathers and dads' issues. I think that's a really great step forward and really interesting.
Absolutely. I just did want to pick up one little, well, correct one little statistic in that last section. Ms. Broderick said that men are more likely to be victims of violence from people they don't know, and women are more likely to be victims of violence from people they do know. Actually, that's a bit of a furphy that's been going around. Certain people like to push that line, but actually, when you look at the Personal Safety Survey, which is the largest survey ever done on violence in Australia, men and women are exactly equal risk of being attacked by someone that they know. So I just wanted to correct that before we move on.
There are some differences, aren't there, in the styles of violence. I mean, men are often hit by instruments or those sorts of things, so they can be quite severely harmed, whereas the reverse tends to be a more physical sort of thing.
Absolutely, that sort of stuff. Unfortunately, the Personal Safety Survey, even though it surveyed those questions, the ABS chose not to publish that data, which is very interesting. Mm. And the other thing that the ABS did when they did this survey on violence is they excluded any violence that occurred on a sporting field. And that most violence against men comes in a biffo at the end of a football match, but somehow that's not considered violence, which is very interesting. So anyway,
entertainment.
It's entertainment to see guys beating each other.
It's the modern day version of the gladiatorial combat. You know,
anyway, it's a very, very complex debate, the whole violence and domestic violence issue, which we won't distract ourselves from too much. We do today have the absolute astonishing honour. She's been away overseas for a while, but we do have the astonishing privilege of having Jermaine Diarrhea back in the studio, and it's really lovely to see you. It really
Jermaine
is.
Jermaine Diarrhea. Well, she did make headlines last year when our much-loved Steve Irwin passed away and criticised him for that. So she's
basically suggesting that a tyranniser of the animal species was thankfully gone.
Well, in 1999, we can quote author Jermaine Greer as once a free love advocate, dubbed a saucy feminist that even men like, changed her tune, condemning men as brutal, lazy sperm factories. Yeah, you see, the good blokes have been replaced by nervous wrecks, metrosexual knobs and toss bags. Well, I can tell you now, today's metrosexual, a man bag toting, dedicated follower of fashion, hair dripping with product, buffed body, reeking of a cologne called something like Le Whiff Pur Le Homme, driving his convertible to the gym to meet his personal trainer while chatting on the latest model mobile phone to a fellow fop about his favourite subject himself. Such stereotypes. Disgraceful behaviour.
So do you, Jermaine, really long for the day when men were men and the sheep were nervous, you know, really
absolutely,
the butch old bloke?
I can. Oh, absolutely. I'll give you a favourite quote from our famous Henry Lawson, 1910. Henry Lawson gushed, "The greatest pleasure I have ever known is when my eyes meet the eyes of a mate over the top of two foaming glasses of beer."
Well, Henry, of course, did have a little bit of trouble with the alcohol.
Did he? I thought he was having trouble with his mates by the sounds of that quote.
Henry Lawson was one of the most beautiful of Australian writers, but there is an air of alcoholic melancholy that drips right through his writing and right through his career. And, of course, he died in alcoholic oblivion.
How about our Jackie Weaver? Offered the following backhanded compliment. "I think men are sex objects because they are only good for sex and not much else. Well, I have to agree with that."
And tell us about this book you published recently with lots of photographs of young boys in states of undress. Is that something that you're partial to?
Well, one of my many hobbies is photography, you see, and young boys in tight shorts. Well, what can I say? You need much more information than that.
A lot of your critics said that accused you, really, of being pedophilic as a result of that book when you went on and on about the beauty of young men. And other people were saying, if it was a bloke, well, you'd be arrested. What do you say to that?
You've got to get them while they're young, dear, especially at my age.
Well, Jermaine is in fine form, and it's very, very good to see you. What's going to be your next project?
Good question, darling. Apart from the photography, I don't know what I'm going to do next. I might write another book.
Really? Well, we'll be back. And Jermaine may well be back.
You never know. You're lacking a big city, darling.
Yes.
And then girls that wore pink, boys that wore blue, boys that always grew up better men than me and you. What's a man now? What's a man mean? Is he rough or is he rugged? Is he cultural and clean? Now it's all changed, it's got to change more, 'cause we think it's getting better, but nobody's really sure. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Gaze a macho, can't you see the leather shine? You don't want to sound dumb, don't want to offend, so don't call me a faggot, not unless you are a friend. Then if you're tall and handsome and strong, you can wear the uniform and I could play along. And so it goes. Between the sexes, then there'll be no people left. And so it goes, go round again. But now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa,
there was a column last week in the Australian newspaper by columnist Janet Albrechtson called Dangerous Sex as the State Enters Bedroom. Now, we've talked in recent months about the proposed new rape reform legislation in South Australia, and actually there was also new rape laws introduced in New South Wales early this year. Now, do you want to read a little bit of that article?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Yeah, it starts off, if you are a man, sex got a whole lot more dangerous. Consider this scenario. A woman meets a man in a bar or at a party. She likes the man, and he likes the woman. She may not normally be a sex on the first night kind of girl, but they have a number of drinks. Fueled by alcohol, they put aside their inhibitions. The woman goes home with the man. She says yes to sex. And in the morning, the man makes it clear it was a one-night stand. The woman is deeply offended and regrets her drunken decision. She claims rape. Under new rape laws introduced in New South Wales this year, that man is likely to be convicted as a rapist, and he is likely to go to prison.
And she goes on to say in this article, "Let us be clear, rape is wrong. It's a crime that calls for imprisonment. It can destroy a victim's life. But let us be clear about something else. Wrongful claims of rape are made, and they can destroy a man's life." She goes on to say, "The fact that this under this new legislation, the fact that the woman who says yes to sex is drunk is highly relevant. It may vitiate her consent. In other words, if she's drunk, she no longer is responsible for her behaviour or for her consent. But," she goes on to say, "the man's intoxication must be ignored when working out whether he had reasonable grounds for believing consent was given. So if he was drunk and thought that she said yes, or believed she said yes and consented, that has to be ignored by a jury." She says it's a curious law that says alcohol only affects the cognitive abilities of women. These new rape laws degrade women. They treat them as helpless victims, stripping them of the power to make decisions about sex after consuming alcohol. Down a few many Bacardi breezes and the law says that you are no longer responsible for your actions. Is this really the message we want to send to young women? She sounds like she's talking a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. What do you think the outcome of all this will be? The same thing's happening in South Australia, isn't it?
Well, it's happening in South Australia, it's happening in Victoria. I think all the states are sort of falling over themselves to introduce these new rape laws that are really very questionable, that they help genuine victims of rape, and they do a lot to imprison men who sleep with women while one or the other of them had been consuming alcohol. And let's face it, a lot of sex happens when people have been consuming alcohol.
Really is political correctness gone crazy, isn't it? Does anyone know what's precipitated these changes to the laws? Who's initiated or instigated these changes, and why? Have we done any research on that? Or has this just been some politician's latest way of gaining some notoriety?
Well, look, Albrechtson actually writes. She says, "Why is this happening? Lawyers point to the perfect storm. The intoxicated man is trapped between a strident but misguided feminist agenda and the law and order lobby driven by perceptions that rape conviction rates are too low." Basically, feminists have been lobbying for years and years and years, and they disguise themselves as, in the case of Victoria, the Law Reform Commission, which sounds all very innocuous and all a good idea. We all want to make sure our laws are up to date. Some of the proposals that they have put forward, which have led to these, it's basically the same old feminist
line. But
it's
not just here. I mean, it's happened in England as well. In Steve Moxon's book, The Woman Racket, he was saying those exact same draconian laws were passed in England last year. So it seems to be a worldwide trend.
It's really interesting that only women are speaking up about this. Heather MacDonald in the City Journal says that it's helped along by feminist victimology and rape industrialists intent on redefining drunken sex, where a bloke wants to get inside a girl's knickers in terms of the classic case of domination rape by power-hungry men.
I think it does. It actually speaks volumes, and I think it's a positive thing that women themselves are recognising that this is basically a load of crap and that they are being demeaned by these laws, because of them, as stated before, that this implies that they're incapable of being responsible for themselves after a few drinks. So I think that's a positive thing that women themselves are speaking out about it. But I think we as men should be equally as appalled in speaking out about these proposed laws as well, because as Greg rightly pointed out, this is an ongoing movement of a select few who wish to imprison men because they simply hate them.
Well, that brings us to the end of Dad's on the Air for the 6th of May 2008. And I'd like to thank Elizabeth Broderick, the new Sex Discrimination Commissioner, for coming on the show. That was a really interesting interview. And don't forget, you can listen to the program at www.dadsontheair.net, as well as our past shows are all up there. Next week, another interesting show coming up. We're going to be looking at new dads. Peter Denman has written a new book and is called Learn a Dad, and is running a series of workshops. There's a new website, www.learnadad.com.au. As we all know, when the kid comes along, it can be quite a shock to the system. So we'll be back next week.
With Dads on the